This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. The Anglo-Irish Treaty sparked turmoil within the IRA. Some accepted it and joined the ranks of the Provisional Government's new National Army. Some remained neutral. The majority opposed it, but with the added twist that on the eve of the Civil War, there were two anti-treaty factions of the IRA, not one. Two army conventions on the 26th of March and the 18th of June 1922 failed to resolve these differences. To make sense of the complexities of the IRA's internal politics on the eve of the Civil War, I'm joined by Shiafra Aiken, who lectures in history at Queen's University Belfast and is the author of Spiritual Wounds, Trauma, Testimony and the Irish Civil War. And that's just been published by Irish Academic Press. John Borgonovo, who lectures in history at UCC and is one of the editors of the Atlas of the Irish Revolution, published by Cork University Press in 2017. John Dorney, editor of the Irish Story website and author of The Civil War in Dublin, The Fight for the Irish Capital, 1922 to 1924, and that was published by Irish Academic Press in 2017. And finally, a regular HedgeGhoul panellist, Brian Hanley, Assistant Professor in 20th Century Irish History at Trinity College Dublin. And this HedgeGhoul is supported by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media under the Decade of Centenaries 2012 to 2023 initiative. Now, John Dorney, just to get us started, if we're talking about the politics of the internal politics of the IRA, we must talk about its structure, its constitution. To what extent were the structures and constitution of the IRA determined by the pre-1914 Irish Volunteers?
Well, Tommy, I think it's fair to say that the treaty split is the clash between two conceptions of what the IRA was. So, on the pro-treaty side, you have the Provisional Government, which views the Irish Republican Army as the army of the Irish Republic, the army beholden, loyal to the Dáil, so it's responsible to the Dáil, but it also means it is under the command of the Dáil and under the command of the government, you know, elected by the Dáil, the ministers, and the chief of staff of the army. So it goes back to the oath they took in 1919. However, and this answers, you know, goes to your question, Tommy, on the anti-treaty side, you have a different conception of what the IRA is. The IRA is a volunteer army, okay? It's elected by its members, elected almost in a trade union form with delegates at local level, all the way up to an executive. And a number of anti-treatyites make this point, especially in their memoirs, like Ernie O'Malley, Todd Andrews, that the IRA is not like a normal army. It's a people's army. The officers are elected. And the IRA, or the army, as they call it, had not been consulted over the treaty. Now, just like the pro-treaty side, the general staff, they view it as the army of the Irish Republic, but they view this, the anti-treatyites do, as incompatible with the oath that they took in 1919, which was to uphold the Irish Republic against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So, you know, you have two conceptions of what the Republican Army is. Now, from the anti-treaty point of view, going back again to this volunteer structure, they say, we have the right to vote on this ourselves. So, the anti-treaty delegates, they are anti-treaty faction, I should say, get together and they proceed to an army convention in March 1922. Now, the army convention...
John, just before you get on to that, Rick, just going back to my original question, were such things as conventions and executives and so on, were they laid down in the original, you know, 1913-1914 Irish Volunteers Constitution?
Yeah, that's the point I was coming to. So the convention of March 1922 is in line with the organization of the original volunteers in 1914. You know, it's conceived as a people's militia. It's democratically elected. The officers at a local, from a local level to the top, are going to be democratically elected. That's what the constitution of the volunteers said. So the anti-treaty IRA position is consistent with that. Now, the thing is, in between, since the rising, but especially in the War of Independence, it hadn't necessarily worked like that. You know, it was during the strains of guerrilla war, officers were more often appointed than elected, and they could be imposed by GHQ in some cases, like Paddy Cooney, for example, sent from Dublin down to Kerry. So, you know, as I said, there existed two rival conceptions of what this was. and whether the 1914 constitution was still appropriate.
Could I just bring Brian Hanley into this point? Because you mentioned their guerrilla war, right? Now, Brian, that's the style of war that was fought in the War of Independence. But did the Irish Volunteers stroke IRA regard themselves as a conventional army?
Yeah, it's a good question, because again, there's this great idea of the IRA as the classic guerrilla force. And there's even people who claim they invented it, which is, you know, not true. But the point is that the Irish Volunteers didn't see themselves initially as a guerrilla army. They saw that they're modeled very, aside from the democracy, their structure is very close to that of a regular army. In fact, very close to that of the British Army, and British Army manuals and so on were used to try and impose parade type discipline. So they're not a militia in terms of, you know, everybody does what they want themselves and they don't take orders, etc. I mean, they have a military structure. There are officers, there are parades, there is, you know, the routines of military life. And in 1914, 1915, there's a debate in the Irish Volunteers about those who see, you know, an insurrectionary form of warfare, a form of warfare in support of a foreign intervention in Ireland, the German landings, for example, and those who talk about what they call at the time hedge fighting, which is closer to what we see as guerrilla warfare. And indeed, you know, some of the people who are in favor of hedge fighting are not in favor of the Easter Rising, for example. So the people who are in the Volunteers who are pushing for insurrection in 1916 are often not the people who are in favor of what becomes later on the classic model of warfare the IRA is associated with. So they do see themselves as a conventional army. And that again speaks to something that, and I've heard even at hedge schools, people are still somewhat surprised by this. I mean, how do we know so much about them? Because they wrote an awful lot down. They believed as an army that they had to keep records of decisions. They had to keep records of local organization. They had to actually write down the amount of weaponry they had, the kind of training they were imposing, the amount of volunteers in localities, which, you know, an army concerned with secrecy so much wouldn't do that. So they're not a secret society. They don't see themselves initially either as primarily a guerrilla force. They do see themselves as the army of the Irish Republic.
John Borganova, can I bring you in on this, right? Is this not a basic contradiction, right? Like an army, a conventional army, has a chain of command, right? Is that not in total contradiction with this idea of a democratic army, if you know what I mean?
Well, there's clearly a tension, as Brian and John had just explained. And if you think about what we're seeing is the IRA is very much a decentralized organization. It's really a flat organization. You know, you get the lowest level, you have companies, which are like parishes, a number of companies form a battalion, a number, which is like a district, a number of battalions form a brigade. And until 1921, all brigades report to a general headquarters staff, like all 70 brigades. And then they add an additional level of unit called a division, which also all report to a general headquarters staff, which is interesting. The general headquarters staff is really closely associated with Michael Collins and Richard Mulcahy. That's not elected. Those guys were self-appointed. And what you start to see is a concentration of power in this GHQ staff, really around the two personalities of Mulcahy and Collins, with a huge amount of overlap with the Irish Republican Brotherhood. So that concentration of power is in tension with the rest of the organization. And the key to the understanding what's going on outside of Dublin and outside of GHQ is that the IRA brigades are governing themselves by and large. They are arming themselves almost entirely, and they're financing themselves almost entirely. So they become these self-governing organizations, bodies, which are kind of organically developing in a similar fashion. And they aren't really getting a centralized, strong ownership and control from the Dublin GHQ. But when it comes to this decision, this really fundamental decision about the Anglo-Irish Treaty to disestablish the Irish Republic, which they have sworn allegiance to, that general headquarters staff demands a command and control it had never exercised before. And it demands that all these units follow in behind their lead without any consultation and without having any voice in the decisions that are made.
Can I just backtrack a little bit here, right? Back to the post-1916 period, right? Because that's when a twin-track approach of rebuilding Sinn Féin, which has now rebranded itself as a Republican Party, and the Irish Volunteers. Right now, was that twin track approach just some sort of an ad hoc thing, or did somebody plan it? Was there any discussion about it? I'm talking about discussion about the military civil relationship. John, what do you reckon?
I think it's organic. I think Sinn Féin develops first. But you know, it takes Sinn Féin a year to develop until 1917. They already had an organization which becomes the IRA. Coming to Mons starts to really develop rapidly as well in 1917, 1918. But I'd argue it's organic, and it is responding to, they're seeing opportunities. There's no pre-plan for a guerrilla army, I don't think. And there's no pre-plan for guerrilla warfare. It's basically, it becomes the best available option to leaders, not just in Dublin, but across the country. That also one of the reasons we have uneven development and an uneven pace of action and organization as well.
Schieffer, just bringing you in, I mean, is this the origin? Is this the nub of the problem here then, of these, you know, the uncertain loyalties of early 1922?
Yeah, well, I think what we said there, that the two-track approach is something that we could even trace back in republicanism even earlier in terms of the Fenians and debates around the new departure. And equally, we see it in 1916 with Old MacNeill not being involved. So I think that tension is already there. And we even see it later on again, let's say when Fianna Fáil come into government in 1932. And obviously that is something that is seen as a betrayal among the more, I suppose, hardline Republican activists. So that's certainly something that we see. So that tension then plays out in the, I suppose, the allegiances and the debates around the treaty. And what's interesting, I think, if we look at a lot of the memoirs and the accounts and what some of these activists are saying, is that it's not an easy decision for a lot of them whether they want to take a pro or anti-treaty position. And there's all sorts of other influential factors. There's peer pressure, there's socioeconomic factors, there's geographic factors as well. But if you think of key leaders like Liam Lynch, initially said that he could recognise some of the good points within the treaty. Frank Aitken, similarly, in his interview with Ernie O'Malley, said that had he been in the Dáil, he may have actually voted in favour of the treaty. We then see cases of activists shifting from a pro-treaty stance to an anti-treaty stance. Sean Lamass was one of quite a number of activists who were training in Beggar's Butt in early 22. Todd Andrews, similarly, was originally pro-treaty following his local brigade. And that goes back to what John said again, that these are essentially self-formed and self-financed and self-governing bodies that have their own allegiances. I've read a lot about Francis Carthy, who was head of the 4th Battalion in South Wexford. And he actually wrote a novel, Legion of the Rearguard, published in 1932, about his Civil War experience. And he has a whole section dedicated to him imagining that he'd been at the treaty debates and kind of weighing up the pros and cons, that this was a huge decision for him. And in his case, again, he had been fitted with an army uniform. So there's all sorts of shifting allegiances. The other thing is there's a number of mutinies. The Bank of Ireland guards, for example, were originally associated with the pro-treaty side, went anti-treaty. There's another case in Portobello Barracks where Republican prisoners are actually almost successful in convincing their guards to take a Republican side. So there's certainly a lot of back and forth. We could also talk about the neutral position again, that there's an actually organisation that is promoting peace during this period, the Dublin Sinn Féin Peace Committee. So maybe there are some points we might come back to.
John Doherty, you wanted to come in on this?
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on a couple of points there, Tommy, quickly. About the civil versus military thing. So obviously this had always been a tension, and especially the likes of Arthur Griffith had always viewed the civil arm of the revolution, if you like, as being the more important arm. You know, and Griffith in 1922 was very strongly of the opinion that the army has no right to voice an opinion in political affairs. It's merely a tool of the government. And this is obviously the position of general staff of the IRA, Mulcahy and Collins in particular as well. But just, I want to disagree slightly with John Borgonovo. You can characterize the division in the IRA as, you know, general staff versus the provinces. I don't think that's the full story for two reasons. Number one, I don't think the IRA is as flat as John says. In Cork, for example, which John's speciality, of course, it does develop in a kind of an independent way, and they don't necessarily listen to GHQ. For example, in the killing of reformers, court does its own thing. That's not true around the country. You much more often see, I think, GHQ imposing its will on provincial IRA units. We see this in Kerry. We see it in Cavan and Monaghan and Leitrim. You know, for my money, the power of GHQ is more important. But the key thing about the treaty split is it's also a split among people who were close to GHQ. So divisional officers, Ernie O'Malley, we all know because of his memoir. But it's interesting to think about O'Malley's trajectory. So O'Malley is not really connected to any unit organically. He's sent out around the country to organize different units by GHQ. So he should be one of the people who's close to GHQ, and yet he's one of their most implacable opponents. So I think the key to understanding is, yes, there's a center against provinces aspect to it, but that's also a split within the center of the organization as well.
I tell you, I want to just, I'll go back to John Borgenhove in a second, right? But I want to go back to Brian Hanley, just on the question of, well, two things, Michael Collins in particular, and also the IRB, right? I mean, from what people are saying here, it seems to me then that the GHQ is basically controlled by the IRB. Is that an oversimplification, Brian?
It's a slight oversimplification because the IRB has mixed elements in it as well. But the key thing is the IRB is a secret society. And the IRB, which had again gone through a lot of changes from its, you know, Fenian heyday, nevertheless, is an important organization in the kind of refoundation of the volunteers and Sinn Féin and everything else after 1917. And people like Collins and so on use it very effectively to reshape this new organization. But right from the start, post 1916, there were people that felt the IRB had confused matters, that the IRB had the secrecy and so on, had no place in a new political movement. So De Valera, who's very briefly in it, leaves it. Carl Brewer leaves it. Jerry Boland leaves it. Obviously, Harry Boland stays in. But throughout the country, you do have a network of IRB activists who are very often important local officers. So there are anti-treatyites in the IRB as well, but certainly Collins and Mulcahy and co. use it very effectively in that GHQ level. It's very, very strong, but it does also, you know, any grouping that sees itself as elite tends to inspire a bit of resentment and suspicion as well. The argument about Collins, I mean, Collins is such a huge figure now, you know, and he dwarfs almost any other discussion about the Civil War and the Revolution. He is both vastly overhyped in many ways in terms of popular memory, but also really, really important. He can be both things at the same time. So he, on the one hand, is not chief of staff of the IRA. He doesn't come up with the ideas of guerrilla warfare and so on. But as director of intelligence and as a central figure in the Dáil and its link with the IRA, he is really, really important to Dublin and GHQ and even to the micromanagement of things like arms supplies. And to a lot of people within the Dublin IRA in particular and some local units, he is seen as, you know, the man, essentially. I think one person describes him as, even without a military title. So the argument that you get that what's good enough for Michael Collins is good enough for me is a really significant argument in terms of loyalty around the time of the treaty debates and the build up to the Civil War. And people who were very, very convinced militarists and very active militarily support the treaty really because Michael Collins supports it. And he's also close, of course, to the IRA across the new border in the north, which is important too. So he is a hugely important figure, if not the originator of all these ideas that he's sometimes depicted as in popular retelling.
And would it be true to say that Collins had a nose for power, right? In other words, like he tended to gravitate to the important levers of power. Like, so he had a foot in both camps. Like he's Minister for Finance, but surely is the most important ministry in the underground Dáil government.
Yeah, I mean, he's an operator. And you know, in the treaty debates, he famously, as all operators do, pretends to be not an operator, says, "I'm only a plain Irish man who's had his principles burnt into him, and I don't really know anything about this politics business," when in fact he was a consummate political operator and networker. But he's more than that. I mean, I think I was surprised myself when I looked at the nitty-gritty of his connection with places like Liverpool and Manchester, how in the midst of all this, he is still paying huge attention to getting one or two handguns from Liverpool every day. And all this kind of stuff, while he's also handling the Dáil loan, while he's also dealing with, you know, sending out people like O'Malley and stuff across the country. So I think he has phenomenal capacity for work and for, you know, inspiring a great deal of loyalty among those around him as well, you know.
Now, there's one question I just want to get answered before we proceed with this discussion. When did the Irish Volunteers begin to be referred to as, quote, Irish Republican Army, unquote. John Dorney, can you shed any light on that? And is that significant?
Oh, yeah, that's actually a relatively easy one, unusually, Tommy. So the volunteers become the Irish Republican Army when they take an oath to Dáil Éireann in January 1919, or following January 1919. It was midway through the year 1919 when they became the Army of the Irish Republic. But I think Brian wants to get in there.
Brian, yeah?
Well, no, it's just interesting that you have in 1917 material being produced to commemorate the Easter Rising, which is referring to officers in the Irish Republican Army. And the term is used in 1916 when the volunteers, Citizens Army and so on come together. But also in 1918, Thomas Johnson of the Trade Union Congress writes this famous article, If the Bolsheviks Came to Ireland. And he compares the Soviets to various Irish movements and says, and, you know, would the Red Army be the same as the local volunteers of the Irish Republican Army? So the term is being used, you know, even before 1919, I think.
Well, it's used by the Fenians in the army that invades Canada in whatever, 18, was it 66? But anyway, I think that's just that, you know, that's the first time Irish Republican Army appears on the battlefield, apparently. John Borgonova, did you want to come in there?
Well, yeah, just, I mean, it's... You know, there's a chain of command. Yes, there's an oath of allegiance. Yes, but the Dáil doesn't really start taking responsibility for IRA actions until 1921. So like midway through the, you know, like I think it's March 21 before they start actually taking formal responsibility. There's intense opposition from GHQ when Eamon de Valera tries to bring in Austin Stack into the GHQ headquarters staff, and they resist it. So there's not so that this if there's also we got to remember that a number of IRA officers are TDs, including a number of guys in GHQ, a number of other lesser known IRA officers are like heads of county councils. And so you don't have a straight binary between civil and military. It's completely overlapped. And that's where a lot of the confusion comes from.
Now, John, just to follow up on that, right? What you've described is a very chaotic, amorphous sort of an organization, if you can even call it an organization. But was that an advantage in the war against the British?
Absolutely.
John Borgonova.
I'll come in and then you can come in. Absolutely, it was. It was, and it basically, the British being a class-based society were always, and this is also part of the myth of Michael Collins. A big part of the myth of Michael Collins comes from the British, because the British come from this class-based society. They always think that they don't really see ordinary, you know, working people as being capable of organizing themselves in a really intelligent and really effective way, which is what the Republican movement does. It does that in the military way. It does that the way it mobilizes women. It does that in the use of propaganda from Sinn Féin. It does that through raising funds at the civil side as well as the military side. It's decentralized. There's no clear center of gravity. It can't be decapitated. This organic development allows people in each locality to develop and take advantage of the political, cultural, economic geography of their areas. And they do so in a really effective way that ultimately defeats the British counterinsurgency campaign.
John Dorney, you want to come in?
So that's a good point that John makes and Brian makes, that the Dáil itself didn't take responsibility until I think May 1921. So it's not a straightforward line. But, you know, the reason for that, I would say, is not so much that, you know, the IRA is forcing events as the events have a momentum of their own. So, for example, the Dáil is banned in late 1919 as a result of the assassination of a number of detectives, following which, you know, there's an attempt to kill the Lord Lieutenant, the barracks are attacked, and the thing snowballs. You know, the Black and Tans are brought in, eventually martial law is declared in the south of the country. So it kind of develops on its own momentum, rather than, you know, this idea, for example, of Dan Breen starting a war and there being a, you know, pre-planned cohort of militarists in the IRA, you know, who are driving events. I'm not sure it's not pre-planned like that. It develops according to its own momentum. And different parts of the country also have different narratives of what has happened. So, like, for example, people in some parts of the country, notably in Cork, think we won the war, or we were in a position of winning the war in the sense that the British had to, you know, contribute massive resources. There's other parts of the country where not much has happened during the War of Independence.
Yeah, that's a point I was going to move on to you, Brian, on the question of localism, right? Local loyalties and personalities. I mean, how important were they?
They're very important. But again, I mean, I think, Tommy, there is organization. It's not completely chaotic. I mean, the attacks on barracks in the spring of 1920 are coordinated as a national effort. And there is a national leadership, you know, that units owe some loyalty to, at least. I mean, it's not completely just that, you know, each locality does its own thing and hopefully it'll all work out. I mean, the successes are emulated and hopefully units learn from failures as well. But what you need very often is, you know, dynamic local officers or local young volunteers. What the democratic structure of the volunteers can be a drawback in is that as people found in 1917, 1918, people would be elected local commanders because they were popular. Just because you're popular doesn't mean you're an effective local commander. You might be popular because you don't ask anybody to do anything. So you do need people who are prepared to take risks. That's often unmarried men, for example. You know, a man with a family and responsibilities, a man in his 30s is often less willing to take risks than a man in his 20s who is, you know, single. So you do find that, you know, the GHQ do send out people like Ernie O'Malley and Andy Cooney to try and promote people who will be effective. And there are complaints that some areas are backward, not doing much. Some areas are doing too much policing and not enough fighting. All areas complain they haven't got enough weapons, which is true. The IRA is very largely underarmed. But I suppose what you've got to kind of stress, and John has, both the Johns have said this, but, you know, this is a popular revolution. It's not simply a war by 5,000 fighters, because the IRA has guns for about 5,000 men. The IRA is a mass volunteer army without very many weapons. So there's a lot more volunteers than there is guns. And an enormous amount of what they're doing, trenching roads, you know, trying to break into the British communication networks, trying to build up intelligence on the British military locally. It might not result in very dramatic ambushes all the time, but it is part of undermining British rule. And it goes along with then the boycotts, the strikes, the raising of money, the massive propaganda effort and so on. So at times, some of the more successful IRA units, I think, forget that these other things are important as well. And as John has said, I think Paddy Mulroe makes the point as well elsewhere about Ulster, that when it comes to the treaty, the IRA units that feel they're successful and really think they're winning don't really see the point in a truce, whereas there's other IRA units who are under huge pressure who welcome a truce as relief. So the picture is very different in different localities. But I think it is a national effort, and it does have a national aim as well as being something that quite clearly can be altered by local conditions.
Yeah, John Dorney, I'll just go to you, because John Borgonovo has described this, you know, flat organization, which is a good way to describe it. And then you have this GHQ, you know, above it, right? So it's like you got the point of the pyramid and you've got the base of the pyramid, right? And kind of an incoherent area in between. Like, so my question to you is, how effective was GHQ?
Yeah, again, I think I disagree slightly on John about this. So I think that the GHQ was quite effective given the resources that it had. You know, especially in Cork, as I said, you have independent brigades. And there, for example, when GHQ makes a concerted attempt at kind of divisionalization, it's called, so creating like regional commands in the IRA, people in Cork are very much against it. They don't like it. But for example, and Shiver can talk about this at length, I suppose, in the border kind of area, the 4th Northern Division, people like it. You know, it's a great way to get resources and money and stuff into the area from GHQ. So, you know, GHQ isn't really able to micromanage the War of Independence, especially Collins, Brian mentioned with his personality, might have liked. But it is able to kind of broadly mold it, you know, and even Cork, who, like I said, often didn't listen to GHQ and had very stormy meetings with the divisional representatives sent down in the spring of 1921, they do mostly toe the line. And the great, you know, the great test to this is really the truce of July 11th, 1921. So an organization that's ill-disciplined, there can't be a truce, right? They're going to keep on, you know, attacks. They're going to keep on crimes if they're not disciplined. And that doesn't happen. You know, the truce breaks down a little bit later on, especially after the treaty. But from July to December 1921, by and large, you know, the IRA is a disciplined enough organization that it accepts the command of GHQ to halt military activities.
Schieffer, could I go to you on the question of law and order, right? How important is that in our discussion?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting because what John has kind of said there is that if we think of the truce period from the summer of 21 until Christmas, let's say 21, that the IRA is still very much well organized well-oiled machine. Considering, I suppose, that there isn't a huge breakdown of law and order, but I think we definitely do see that increase. And what is interesting, I think, too, is the fact that there is these threats of popular social unrest, from even earlier, from 1921, and we see that with the establishment of worker Soviets across the country, particularly in Munster. And I think that's something that's maybe written out of the Civil War narrative to a certain extent. But that really comes to the fore then after the treaty and the establishment of the provisional government. I think in January 22, the railway workers in Cork are demanding their needs are met in terms of 8 hours a day for their work a day. We also see then Soviets in terms of flour mills, gas works, the women even in Tipperary taking over the gas works for the workers. And of course, we have then the occupation of the Rotunda in Dublin by Limo Flaherty and Jim Phelan and Sean McIntyre for the Dublin Council of the Unemployed. So these are all I suppose indicative of both the period of this popular unrest, also the breakdown of law and order once we have the removal of British forces, that there's a breakdown in this, and it's also in terms of the let's say security for the employers, that with the breakdown of law and order and the court systems, that there's less I suppose consequences, and that these workers are able to mobilise. And what's interesting here is that Cleves in Clonmel, what interestingly enough was occupied, and the provisional government actually make a cabinet meeting decide that if this Soviet worker Soviet isn't repressed, that they will actually repress it by force in the summer of 1922. And it's only really when they realise that the workers Soviets are less of a threat that they decide then to bombard the forecourts. So I think that that background and the backdrop of the popular unrest is something that maybe is underestimated, but certainly there in the background all through this period.
Apart from the divisions over the treaty, you have the fact that, you know, the RIC, British Army, are scarce on the ground.
Yeah, they are. I mean, there is, firstly, there's a crime wave during the revolutionary period, and that does get worse during the truce and after. And one of the big jobs that the IRA, even the pre-split IRA, has to try and do is keep this under control. So into the spring of 1922, while the treaty is being debated, you see lots of reports of armed robberies, post office robberies, bank robberies, people being shot, farmers being robbed, pubs being robbed, and so on. And it's very interesting when you examine who's doing it, because firstly, you've got plenty of ordinary, decent criminals, and you also have quite a few British servicemen who've decided to make a bit of money before they head home. And also then members of both IRA factions are involved in various criminal activities as well. And it adds to the kind of sense of chaos. And along with that, as Shifra has said, you've got an upsurge in working class militancy and agrarian militancy, which again, it isn't just the provisional government are concerned about it, because, you know, Dan Breen, for example, is very contemptuous of what he calls the red flag regime in Clonmel. And you've got anti-treaty IRA members in Tipperary who are involved in putting down some of the workplace occupations there too, and actually shooting down a red flag at one stage. But there is, you know, this sense that things are beginning to unravel. And the withdrawal ultimately then of the British from most of the 26 counties, I mean, their position is that they'd be able to re-intervene if they needed to quickly. But it must have looked to everybody as if they were, you know, they're gone. And of course, that's a huge boost to the idea that something tangible has happened. You know, the British are actually leaving their barracks that they've occupied for hundreds of years. But a lot of these barracks are then reoccupied very quickly, usually by anti-treaty forces. So it adds, I suppose, to the sense that the facts on the ground are that you've got a provisional government in Dublin, but that doesn't necessarily control other parts of the country.
Yeah, can I go to John Dorney? Do you want to come in on this? Because apart from the fact the British are withdrawing, right, you have the treaty and the divisions over the treaty. So what sort of effect does this have on the discipline and morale of the IRA post-treaty? Because you painted a picture there of pretty good discipline for the 6 months after the truce.
Yeah, so, I mean, after the truce, you know, you have an armed truce. You have the RIC, including its auxiliaries in black and tans, and the British Army still in situ. You have the IRA basically parading openly and so on. Now, there are concerns about discipline. Don't get me wrong. There are especially concerns that the IRA are collecting unofficial levies and taxes and so on to fund themselves in the truce period. However, as you say, the discipline and the law and order situation really breaks down. But first of all, the RIC is disbanded. Now, they're not totally disbanded till August 1922, but they're withdrawn from almost all rural areas right after the treaty. The British Army immediately starts to concentrate in big areas like Dublin and Cork, and they're gone from everywhere except Dublin by about June, you know, so outside of Northern Ireland, of course. So the IRA is supposed to, as Brian says, maintain law and order. Like, this is one of the things that Richard Mulcahy, the chief of staff, emphasizes to the anti-treatyites when he meets them. We must keep the army together to maintain law and order, but it doesn't happen. And as a result, as Brian says, you have a lot of freelance crime, but you also have the first clashes between the pro and anti-treatyites actually happens in April 1922. I might be anticipating a little, but the first armed clashes, and we're talking about shootouts in various towns, Mullingar, for example, also in Donegal, also in Dublin, happen over which faction is going to occupy the local barracks and who's going to keep law and order. So also the anti-treatyites are no longer paid by GHQ. And this again goes back to my earlier point that GHQ is important, that garrisons aren't being paid by GHQ if they're anti-treaty. So what do? They start robbing post offices and banks to fund themselves. And so you have a really chaotic...
When is that decision made, John? Sorry, just when did they stop paying anti-treaty?
It's after the convention of March 1922, when the anti-treaty side is formally established, basically, and renounces the authority of GHQ.
But they were paid up to that?
They were paid up to that, yeah, as if they were occupying barracks, if they were full-time troops, yeah.
Okay, Brian, can I go to you then about the... Let's look at the 26th of March convention, right? Now, what is an army convention? And had one been convened before this? Irish Volunteer Days.
Yes, I mean, the Army Convention is the decision-making body that elects an executive and an army council to lead the IRA. And due to the conditions of the War of Independence, there hadn't been one since the 1917, I think.
Was it meant to be held annually, or was there any stipulation on that?
I think in theory it's supposed to be held annually, and in the entire history of the IRA there's been long periods when they haven't been held due to war and conflict and so on. But yeah, I mean, in the late 20s, early 30s, when things were a bit quieter, they were held every year, and you might have them twice a year if there was a crisis in the organization. But the point is here, I suppose, and this is one where, again, we've got to be clear, I think, for people, is that when the treaty split happens, it's not a simply pro and anti split. There's an enormous amount of confusion. There is an enormous amount of to-ing and fro-ing. And you then have effectively a grouping who take the pro-treaty side and who become the core, ultimately, of the National Army. And that includes a very large number of the kind of experienced operators in Dublin and so on. But you have a very large number who remain neutral. And that's a significant, you know, including many of the hardened fighters in Cork. Florence O'Donoghue, Sean O'Hegarty, for example, are neutral during the Civil War. Frank Aiken in Louth, it remains neutral up until he's forced onto the anti-treaty side to some extent. And then you have those who are opposed to the treaty. And the majority of the IRA, the figure is 75% or so, they say, are anti-treaty. Now, again, I would caution that Donegal is pro-treaty, but that doesn't mean there aren't anti-treaty IRA men in Donegal. And Tipperary is anti-treaty, but that doesn't mean there aren't Tipperary pro-treaty IRA men as well. But overall, a majority are against the treaty. But not all of them are prepared to fight over it, or a lot of them would rather fight the British rather than fight fellow Irishmen. So you've got, effectively, ultimately, two anti-treaty IRAs. One very militant, led by people like Gerny O'Malley and Rory O'Connor, who ultimately occupy the forecourts. And then a larger group around Liam Lynch and so on, who do want to try and maintain some form of unity while opposing the treaty. And the convention really is the anti-treaty IRA emerging and saying that we're not going to accept this. This is a rejection of the Republic. It's a betrayal of what we've been fighting for. Richard Mulcahy and GHQ say that there's no right to hold this convention. You know, they try to outlaw it. The anti-treatyites hold it in defiance. It's a very big public display. They've got an armored car, for example, that they drive up Dawson Street, I think, and they, you know, thousands of their supporters are present as well. And this is really a sign of a large part of the IRA is not going to accept the treaty. But that masks divisions within that anti-treaty group as well.
But did the 26th of March convention repudiate the authority of the Dáil, or did that happen later?
Yeah, it did. It's the thing that the convention says is the authority of the army is vested in the executive, so not in the Dáil.
Now, Judge,
and also, this, sorry, Tommy, one more thing. It also says, and this is what they present as well to the GHQ, is the army is the army of the Irish Republic. And so what this means is that the Dáil of the Free State, or as they would call it, the Parliament of Southern Ireland, has no authority over us. And that's what they argue.
Now, isn't this strange, right? Because later, the IRA in the 1920s and later, you know, makes a fetish of the second Dáil. Right, you know, so it seems like that whatever authority they claim, what the authority that they claim to have later, was based on the authority of the second Dáil, yet they have repudiated, which seems like shooting yourself in both feet, really, in many respects, John.
Yeah, but this is very theological stuff, Tommy. But you're right. But what the IRA says in early anti-treaty IRA says in early 1922 is, as you said, the authority in the army is vested in the executive, not in the Dáil. But what Eamon de Valera says is, the army, the Parliament of the Republic is the second Dáil. The second Dáil is still in session, and we're not paying any attention to this other thing called the Parliament of Southern Ireland. Okay. Yeah. Now, you can argue about this and the validity of it, but what happens in terms of broader IRA history is after the Civil War, you have the de Valera line again. The Civil War, the second Dáil, rather, was never broken up, was never superseded by a third Dáil. Okay, it's still in session, is what they argue. Now, the IRA doesn't actually accept that as their ideology until later on. I think it's 1939.
So, you say this is ideology or maybe even theology after the fact?
Yeah, it basically is.
Right.
They're not really thinking in these kind of theological terms in 1922. It's much more, we stand for the Republic, we're not going to allow you to give it away.
Brian Hanley, do you want to come in on that? Because I know your original research was very much in the 1920s, the post-Civil War. The second Dáil.
The second Dáil really becomes the sacred institution again after 1939, Tommy. It's a desperate move by Sean Russell and kind of the rump of the IRA to get legitimacy for a declaration of war on Britain. And I think John is right. In 1922, they're not really. I mean, I think a lot of the hardline anti-treatyites are really not that concerned at all about which Dáil there is, because as far as they're concerned, they're fighting for the Republic, and that is in danger of being betrayed under the treaty. So I think, again, some of it is after the fact. But I think the key thing is that there is a debate among the anti-treatyites about the best way forward. And some of them are quite dismissive to the point of saying that, you know, we're not going to allow this new provisional government to have elections. And Rory O'Connor makes a notorious statement at a press conference about, you know, when he's asked, you know, does this mean a military dictatorship? He says, well, you can take it that way if you like. Now, in terms of PR, you know, that's quite a disastrous move, because it allows the provisional government to say that these people, you know, are having this illegal, you know, what is basically an illegal convention, are potential dictators. They're going to take over the country no matter what you say. Now, a large part of the anti-treaty IRA doesn't think that. You know, they are far more, aware of the need to try and maintain some level of popular support, or at least, you know, some put forward the idea of we restart the war with Britain, bring everybody back together, and so on. But the anti-treatyites are divided in a way that, in some ways, the pro-treatyites aren't, which aids their cause as well.
I just want to just swing the conversation here slightly, right? I want to go to Schaefer, right, on events in the north. Now, our last head school, we looked at Northern Ireland in 1922, because there may have been a truce in July 1921, but there was no truce in certainly not in Belfast. Schaefer, how significant are events in the north on our discussion here?
I think that events in the north are far more significant maybe than is often being considered previously, I suppose, in conceptions of the Civil War, so often seen as a Southern Civil War. And I think that's why even the last podcast and the research by Paddy Mulroe and Kieran Glennon is so interesting in terms of expanding our understanding on the impact of events in the North. I suppose that the first thing to say is that partition is often seen as not being central to the treaty debates. And that might be based on the fact that at this stage, partition had already been established, and the state of Northern Ireland had already been established under the Government of Ireland Act 1920. And the treaty came with the provision then of the Border Commission, which would realign the border. And I think there was a lot of hope attached to that, particularly in the border counties, that areas in Fermanagh, Tyrone and South Armagh would become part of the Free State. But then if we move away from that, there are a number of key events that directly line up with what's happening in Dublin. And I think even if we just think of how visible events were, we could think of the fact that so many of Belfast refugees from Belfast were in Dublin during the early days of the Civil War. So in terms of the Belfast violence, really from 1920 to 1922, there's spiralling violence across Belfast, and that really increases and intensifies then from November 1921. And we get a great account of that by Ernie O'Malley, actually, who describes both in his fiction and his memoir of the Kildare Street Club actually being occupied by both anti-treaty IRA, and then it's set up as accommodation for these families fleeing from Belfast. But in a more kind of tangible sense, then it's bound up with what happens with what the events, I suppose, leading up to the bombardment of the forecourts. Leo Henderson, for example, anti-treaty IRA, was involved in a raid on cars in Dublin, and this was part of efforts to bring arms up north. And when this raid was being carried out, the provisional government swooped in, I suppose, and repressed that raid, and then arrested Leo Henderson. And this led to these further tensions between the pro and the anti-treaty side. Because Leo Henderson, of course, in retaliation to the arrest of Leo Henderson, Ginger O'Connell on the pro-treaty side was arrested and kidnapped, I suppose, by the anti-treaty IRA. And that then was used as an excuse for the bombing or the bombardment of the forecourts subsequently. So I don't know if Brian wants to come in there on that.
Yeah, you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's very important in terms of its radicalizing effect, obviously, south of the border, and the anger it provokes when news of the McMahon murders and the Weaver Street bombing and so on occurs. And also then because you have this tightrope act where, again, for a variety of motives, Collins and others in the pro-treaty leadership, including people like Sean McKeown and so on, and particularly Ona Duffy, are involved in aiding both pro and anti-treaty factions along the border in terms of a planned northern offensive. And I should say as well, because it's coming up to the centenary, that, you know, while the convention is, the IRA convention is taking place in Dublin, you do have killings in Dunmanway in West Cork, hugely controversial killings of local Protestants, which are related, obviously, to the violence in the north as well. And the fact that Southern Unionists begin to fear that they will be victims of an upsurge in violence. The new provisional government says, no, we're going to protect all the citizens, no matter what their religion. There's a wave of condemnation of these killings and so on, and anti-treaty leaders rush back to West Cork to try and find out what's going on. But nevertheless, it is linked to this sense of, you know, there's still the unresolved question of the North. There's secretly plans for an IRA offensive to involve, you know, the people who've occupied the forecourts know about this plan, as do the people who are demanding that they leave the forecourts. So you've got this hugely confusing and very bloody situation north of the border, which is adding then to the sense of chaos in the south.
John, just continuing on the northern angle here, right? And the northern offensive, right? This chimera, right? Was that real, or was that just a ruse to kind of wrong foot the anti-treaty IRA?
Well, it was real to the people who started the attacks, and to the northern units. It was used as a possible way of keeping the IRA unified in the run up to the general election. And did Collins always intend for it? He probably did intend for it to be initiated. I think he realized at a certain stage that it was going to create so much blowback from the British that he couldn't continue and pursue it. And then the actual results were, you know, really, really a damp squib as well. So,
John, was it, more than that though, was it not extremely reckless, right? Because meanwhile, almost every able-bodied Protestant male who could walk, like, was armed in the North, had you know, been inducted into the B specials. I mean, you had 35,000, you know, armed B specials in the North. I mean, did they expect to just sweep these people aside?
Well, I think also this is also a key part of the IRA, key context of the IRA split. Keep in mind, when the IRA occupied the Four Courts. They also occupied the Kildare Street Club, and I think they do was it the Freemason Hall as well, to house Catholic refugees. So in March and April, the expulsion of Catholics was a major political issue, and it was seen as an inadequate response. So I think the political necessities demanded that something be done, even if it was, even if he said, Tommy, it was totally reckless and it was never going to work. Might have been the least of a bad options that were available. Although as it turns out, it totally failed and was ultimately counterproductive.
John Dorney, you want to come in there?
Yeah, I wanted to speak a little bit about the anti-treaty politics and the role of the North in that, because I think it's something that's not enough appreciated. Now, we've talked about the Four Courts is obviously occupied in April 1922. That's an extreme faction of the anti-treaty IRA, first of all. Now, you've got Rory O'Connor, O'Malley, we've talked about, Liam Mellows. Now, some of the pension statements that we have, particularly a volunteer called Patrick Lamb, talks about how he was working for Liam Mellows, and his job was trying to assassinate British soldiers in Dublin to try to provoke a war with the British again. But this also ties in with the North. Like, when the Four Courts was attacked in late June 1922, one of the reasons why the explosion was so big is in the Four Courts when went on fire was that loads of explosive was stored there to be transferred north. And as Sheepers already said, the actual spark for the Civil War was the arrest of Leo Henderson, who was seizing cars in Baggot Street from a firm that was still doing business with the North. So the anti-treatyites were trying to enforce Belfast boycott. They were also doing things like, John Borgonova just mentioned this, but they were housing Belfast refugees in Dublin from property they seized from Dublin Unionists. So they seized the Orange Hall on Parnell Square. They seized the Kildare Street Club on Kildare Street. They seized the Freemasons Hall, and they housed Belfast refugees there. So the anti-treatyites are trying to project themselves as the real champions of Irish nationalists. And at the same time, they're trying to provoke really a war with the British, or an extreme faction of them are. Now, one thing that just to consider, and John Regan has written about this, for example, they appear to have been planning some sort of attack across the border as well, just before the Four Courts was attacked. Todd Andrews speaks about this in his memoir. He was sent to County Cavan just before the outbreak of the Civil War to plan attacks over the border to try to provoke some sort of confrontation there as well. So not that this would have been successful, but I mean, it was part of the anti-treaty plan. And again, an extreme faction of them, because Liam Lynch and others in the Southern divisions aren't in sympathy, but an extreme faction in the Four Courts faction really wants to provoke a crisis with the British, whether in Dublin or in the North, to try to collapse the treaty.
John Borgonova, just move on to something slightly different here now, is the second convention on the 18th of June. Now, the first one seems to have produced two anti-treaty factions. So what did they hope to achieve by a second convention? Like, whose idea was that?
Well, the first one, there was a tension in with the first convention and this follow-up one when they set up the executive. And there's an argument that you set up, that you seize control right away, kind of a military dictatorship right away. And there's a more moderate faction that, you know, you try to undermine the treaty, but keep the whole movement unified. And, you know, that's best personified by Liam Lynch and the First Southern Division folks who are like, I think there's six on the IRA executive. That moderate faction ultimately goes into negotiations with the Free State officers. They produce the Army Unification Agreement, which basically, and it's also part of a whole piece. This is also what produces the agreement that comes about with the PACT election. The idea of creating a coalition government after a general election and running a panel. It's the idea of creating an agreed, accepted unity government and unity in the Army. Now, the key to this is Michael Collins has been promising a constitution that will reduce the imperial connections. And he's been promising that for months, even going back to the beginning of January. He's been promising that the constitution that's going to be produced will not be as onerous in terms of the Republican position. Now, that constitution is only released on the day of the general election. And that undermines support within the IRA for this unification agreement. So the final convention is a a motion is going to be voted on about this Army Unification Agreement, whereby the anti-treaty IRA or the IRA will enter into government if it can agree to the Minister of Defense. And they'll have both pro and anti-treaty folks in the general headquarters staff. They have a whole formula for this. Now, when that convention meets, rather than immediately vote on that resolution, the rival, a war resolution, which John just alluded to, is put forward by Tom Barry, which is we give the British 72 hours and then we start a war, and we start an offensive against them. And if that is carried, then hostilities will begin and we'll hopefully reunify the movement. That's the idea anyway.
Can I just comment here, right?
Yeah.
I mean, were these people deluded, right? Because it seems to me that part of the problem is that they have an inflated sense of their own military capacity, right? Now, possibly that's because of the speed of the British withdrawal, that the huge sections of the country are occupied by anti-treaty people. Up to this time, this has been mentioned several times, they're starved of weapons. I'm assuming there's loads of weapons coming in, like after the truce. So they think they're better armed than anybody else. But of course, everyone else is getting armed. British are still well armed. And the National Army, as it is becoming known, is definitely, getting better armed. So, I mean, where are they suffering from delusions of their own military capacity?
Maybe that's a possibility, but they also are seeing that this whole treaty is being passed on the threat of British war. That's why everyone's pro-treaty. They're not pro-treaty because they want to become an imperial dominion. They're for pro-treaty because the British have threatened immediate and terrible war if they don't accept the treaty. So they feel that gives them almost a responsibility to fight back rather than to acquiesce. Now, in terms of pragmatically, yeah, you're right. And that's why it's not a majority position within the IRA. And if we think about the IRA anti-treaty sentiments, a lot of the IRA end up becoming neutral. They oppose the treaty and they don't fight in the Civil War, as Schieffer mentioned. In this final convention, the war resolution is narrowly defeated. And that leads to a walkout by the militants led by Liam Mellows and Rory O'Connor. So they walk out of the Mansion House. They reestablish themselves in the forecourts. And they lock out Liam Lynch and the moderates, and they elect a new chief of staff with Joe McKelvey at Belfast and a new headquarters. So it's an open split between kind of the moderates and the militant anti-treaty IRA leadership. There's kind of three IRAs, and that split is what gives the Free State government the confidence to attack the forecourts, because they think the forecourts only represents this militant faction. And they think that if they can go in there and decapitate and take out the forecourts leadership, the militant leadership, they'll solve the problem. And they think the whole thing is going to be over in a week or two.
And that's a major miscalculation on their part, is it not?
Right. Right. Okay. And so they don't know that there's already reunification, because part of what the moderate position is, they're trying to find a way to round the circle and around the square or whatever, the square of the circle, I should say. They're looking for a way to bridge the gaps that have emerged between the two sides. And they're being quite imaginative in the way they're doing this, but it's not ultimately they're not successful.
Brian Handy, you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think John is right. And of course, again, to go back to a very early question, taking over the forecourts and fighting it out in Dublin isn't guerrilla warfare either. The anti-treaty IRA only revert to that when they're effectively, pushed out of Dublin and elsewhere. But what they forget, of course, is that there's other people involved in all this. And I really think you have to go back to the truce to see where the popular movement begins to demobilize, because people do want peace. Even if this peace is being imposed under the threat of immediate and terrible war, I think you can see that popular opinion would not have supported a resumption of war with the British. I mean, if the IRA had managed to provoke the British into an offensive against them, they wouldn't have had the same support they had the year before. And I think they often seem to forget that. They often seem to assume we're better armed, we've got more people, we've had lots of time to train, and therefore we don't really need all this other stuff. In April 1922, there's a general strike. The Trade Union Congress calls a general strike against militarism. And again, it gets gets critiqued quite a lot by people who say, well, that was just a free state strike. But, you know, general strikes are hard to organize. And if there's mass support for one, which is against the drift of civil war, it means a lot of ordinary people did not want a war. So they're going to blame the people who start one. You know, if we want to ask the question, why does the Free State get away with so much vicious repression, which provoked a huge backlash when the British did it? It's partly because this war is unpopular. And, you know, the anti-treatyites don't see themselves as being in the wrong. But nevertheless, I think they misjudge the need for popular support. And they kind of seem to forget how important popular support was to, in many ways, the way the struggle had gone on against the British.
Just before I go to John Borgonovo, like, I mean, at several head schools over the last 2-3 years, the whole question of the counter state, that popular mobilization across a broad front, trade union movement and women, the whole thing. I mean, was there a complete lack of appreciation amongst, you know, rank and file military guys in the IRA that they were simply the cutting edge of a much broader movement? John Borgonovo, do you want to comment on that? They were just one part of a much, much more complex machine.
Absolutely. And Brian just nailed it. Absolutely. And that's why they don't have popular support. And they don't understand that they can't wage successful guerrilla war without a broad base of popular support. And as Brian said, they're being blamed for triggering this. And they increasingly lose popular support. And that is why they are defeated. They're defeated in a way that, you know, we can talk about whether the British, you know, how the War of Independence ended up as kind of a draw. It's very clear what the result was in the Civil War. The IRA was crushed, and they were crushed because they fought an opponent who enjoyed a degree of public support the British never had. And the long lead up to the Civil War, as these guys have been saying, also the people wanted stability because things were so unstable as a result of the rapid British withdrawal. And that created such uncertainty that, as Brian said, some governance was better than no governance under a Dominion solution was better than no governance. And because of that desire for stability, public opinion really gravitated towards the Free State in a way that the Republicans didn't anticipate and couldn't deal with.
This is a universal point, because people often wonder, you know, how do dictatorship flourish? And mainly they flourish because the basic desire of most people is simply for law and order, for a quiet time, you know, a quiet life, or to get on with their business, you know. Because, I mean, mention has been made already that, you know, Rory O'Connor basically threatening a military dictatorship. In the end, that's what we got on the Free State side. It could be argued, I'm not saying it could be argued, you know, it was a military dictatorship. Even the decision to bombard the forecourts wasn't taken by the provisional government's cabinet, as I understand it. John Dorney, you want to comment on that? I mean, I what I want to move on to then, just to wrap this discussion up, is, you know, could the Civil War have been avoided? And I mean, I'm not just talking putting the onus on the anti-treaty side, but also from the pro-treaty side.
Yeah, well, I just like to briefly deal with your previous point, though, Tommy. You know, this is very much the anti-treaty rhetoric throughout the Civil War, that it's not a democratic government they're fighting against. It's a military junta, and it's led by, you know, War Council of Mulcahy, Collins, and O'Duffy, and so on. There's some basis to that, in the sense that there had been an election. The pro-treatyites got the majority of votes, but that DAW was not allowed to meet until September 1922, after the death of Michael Collins. And Collins, who was effectively the head of the provisional government, like, he, you know, in theory stepped down, but he's really the head of the government, and he declares himself, without reference to anyone else, the head of the army when the Civil War breaks out. And this is the anti-treaty case. However, I mean, it's, you know, it is only fair to say there is an election beforehand and there is an election afterwards. And in both of those elections, pro-treatyites get the majority of the votes. So, you know, their case is they're simply upholding the will of the people, you know. So if we're balanced, we should acknowledge both sides in that. Now, could the Civil War have been avoided? You know, one thing we haven't talked about, which is only fair to mention, is the role of the British. So there is a compromise worked out together with John Borgonovo mentioned in May 1922 with the IRA and with the pact election. And the idea is that they'll get together a constitution where there won't be an explicit oath to the British monarch. And that would have been enough, in my view, to prevent the Civil War. Now, there was a few people who were against that compromise, but most of the anti-treaty IRA would have gone along with that. Now, that was vetoed very explicitly by the British government. Churchill said, "We will reoccupy Dublin militarily. We will put down any such republic that's declared." So he characterises as a republic any Irish state that doesn't have an oath of allegiance to the monarchy. So, the you know, people nowadays don't understand the importance of the oath of allegiance, but it was a red line to the British as well. Now, I also think, though, that, you know, the people in the forecourts, this, which, again, is the extreme faction of the anti-treaty IRA, were determined to have a confrontation. So, as John Borgonovo said, they publicly declared war on the British. Again, you said that's a very inflated sense of their military capability, as you said. They carried on with the Belfast boycott, seizing materials and so on in Dublin. They also were probably planning attacks across the border. They raided the Civic Guard and they took their armory in the Curragh just before the Civil War. So that faction, there was going to be some sort of confrontation anyway, I feel. But had it not been for the wider political situation, it wouldn't have been a civil war. It would have been just like an incident, I think.
Okay, just can I just say just that I deliberately haven't gone into the British government's role in this, because that will be the topic of a head school in June, which will take place actually during the big national conference, civil war conference in UCC, which I know John Borgonovo is heavily involved in organising. So we will be coming back to that question, because that they obviously have a whole role in this. Schieffer, do you want to comment on that? I mean, on the question of whether the civil war could have been avoided?
Yeah, I think we could debate all day about the various different factors. But I do think what's interesting is that if we look at even some of the earlier discourses, that this is already a discourse of civil war from early 22 and from even in 21, that there's already a sense that civil war is the imagined outcome. And I think once you have that kind of sense, and we see it, I think Frank O'Connor talks about it, seeing the seeds of civil war lingering over the treaty debates, it's very hard to even stop something once it's already in the popular imagination. And I would just go back to what John said in terms of the British government, that obviously the British government is such a huge factor in this, and this will be the discussion for the next podcast. But that threat of immediate and terrible war lingering over the events, and obviously that leading then to the bombardment of the forecourt, is a huge factor. So there's both the militant IRA stance aside, who are going to be causing trouble, but equally the role of the British government in that. So I think with all those factors colliding and these discourses, these pre-discourses, I suppose, of civil war, it was definitely going to be very hard to prevent.
Ryan, can I just go to you for a final word? Now, if I've heard correctly in this discussion, what it seems to me that has been completely blown out of the water is any simple idea of kind of Democrats versus militarists, right? That this is a very complicated situation, and that you've got Democrats and militarists on both sides of this question. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think the idea that you've got potential dictators being thwarted by essentially the birth of Irish democracy is now, you know, an idea that's been totally undermined by people like John Regan's book, The Irish Counter-Revolution, and just by a wider awareness of the importance of Britain. And I know it's going to be discussed again, but the threat of immediate and terrible war poisons Irish politics. It poisons the political atmosphere. It makes it impossible for there to be a genuine debate about the merits of the treaty, because, you know, if you're telling people that the outcome of one decision is going to mean a huge war, it makes it very, very difficult for any real discussion to happen about the treaty. So I think an awareness of that shows that really there's a myriad of factors here, and there are moderates and militants on both pro and anti treaty sides. And there are attempts to avoid. And what I've become more aware of myself is, you know, the sheer level of numbers of officers and volunteers within the IRA who take a neutral stance, or who take, you know, who very reluctantly enter into conflict. And who do, in many ways, do so under huge pressures. And those pressures are, again, you know, stimulated by the British threat and by the British demand after the assassination of Henry Wilson and so on, that something be done in Dublin about the forecourts. And we can't forget that Britain was the single biggest holder of a gun in those circumstances, more powerful than either of the pro and anti-treaty sides.
Okay, I think we'll wrap it up there, Brian, because as I say, you've teed things up nicely for the head school that will take place on the 18th of June. And this will be a live head school down in Cork, when we'll be looking at the assassination of Henry Wilson, which may or may not have been ordered by Michael Collins, of course, incidentally. So we'll try and tackle that one, listeners, at that hedge school, if you can join us. But our next hedge school, which will be at the end of April, it'll be a one-on-one interview with Terence Dooley. And I will be discussing his book, Burning the Big House, the story of the Irish country house in a time of war and revolution. But listen, I'd just like to thank our speakers here today, Shaffra Aiken, John Borgonovo, John Dorney, and Brian Hanley. And I'd like to thank you, the listeners, and I hope you tune in for our next History Ireland Hedge School. Thank you.